to episode 16 of the Final Boss Blues podcast. My name is Killam, and I finally return after a long leave of absence.
We all return after a long leave of absence.
I have returned as well.
You were never here to begin with. Anyway, I'm joined with the usual host, Despain.
Yo.
And today we have a special guest, Captain Jet.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about your heroes in battle. This covers character strategies, character stats, balancing, and all the stuff that really makes the meat of your battles. So
yeah, originally we were going to talk about databasing, but the subject of the database and RPG Maker is massive. I mean, it goes from not just your heroes and their stats, but it also covers items, enemies, all that kind of stuff. So today we're really going to try to focus on your heroes, their abilities, their statistics, the character, the role of the hero in battle, that kind of thing. We're going to try to narrow down on that and look at a variety of ways to make your characters matter in battle.
Let's just pass it to Despain with variety of characters.
The first thing we want to talk about are your characters themselves and the roles that each character plays in battle. I think it's important that different characters, not only are they differentiated by their statistics and their skill sets and their personality, which falls more on the writing side, which we're not going to be covering, but it's also important that they should fit into a theme for the game itself. Does that make sense? Like, even though all the characters are different, the battle system and the gameplay that you want your game to have, all of the characters should build into a type of system where they're different, but also the same in a way. Maybe Killam can expand on that idea a little bit more.
Well, you mean like every character is useful, there's really no bad team, and they're interchangeable, or something much deeper than that?
Well, I mean, first off, I'm speaking broadly before we go into the roles of the individual characters. Say that you have your battle system in your game is focused very much on strategy, and the battles are very long. So you want each of your characters to build toward that same idea, if that's the type of battle you want in your game. Some other games might have more fast-paced battle system in general, and the system itself might lend itself better towards quick battles, and you'd want to balance the characters, all of them, in a way that encourages that style of play, if that's the kind of thing you're going for.
Yeah, I get it. So, like, a strategic battle system would have a lot of buffs and debuffs that take a while to play out, but in the end benefit you, while a quick battle system would just be cast the strongest type of magic and skill and just eliminate the enemy completely.
Yeah, that's the fun one.
Yeah, those are good examples. Basically, the point that I'm trying to make before we go into details on the characters themselves is that think of your game overall and the type of feel that you want the gameplay to have. And before you even start looking at all the characters as individuals, think of how the party functions as a whole and how the characters will go towards a certain style of gameplay that will define your game.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Have a central mechanic already in place and then base off everyone else around that, yeah.
So with that kind of as the foundation, where you have an idea of what you want your gameplay to look like, then we can look at the actual characters themselves. In most RPGs, you'll have typical classes. You know, you'll have an all-around character. Usually the hero can do a little bit of everything. But then there's also the healer, of course, and there's a character who specializes in
magic, destructive magic.
Yeah, magic, and a character who specializes in physical attacking. And then, you know, there might be some novelty characters like the thief, that kind of thing.
Yeah, tank. You can go on and on.
Yeah, there's hundreds of classes you can come up with. And the coolest ones are the original ones, which I'd like to talk a little bit about the original type of classes that people can come up with. Maybe come up with some fun examples. We can do that in a little bit. But before that, I want to talk about some of the classic archetypes for the hero classes. The first one I want to talk about is the healer, specifically because pretty much every game has a healer or two. You know, so Killam, what are your thoughts on the healer character?
Well, as you know, we actually had an argument about this a little while ago. My big beef with the healer characters in general is that aside from healing, they're absolutely useless. So what I want to do when I make my healers, make them useful in terms of combat as well. Because you're not going to heal every single turn. So what, for example, if you're playing any JRPG like Final Fantasy IV and your healer knows no attacks and no one needed healing, what the hell would you do? Nothing. It'd just be a blank turn. I want to avoid that by giving my healer attacks to make them useful. I don't like the standard healer archetype. I really don't like it.
Healers, some games do give their healers like more purpose than just healing. They'll give them the protection spells like Protect and Shell, or they'll give them, you know, the classic holy attack that usually does magic-based damage. You know, not all the healers are completely useless, but usually you'll just find one, and on those blank turns, you just attack with whatever rod or staff you can equip them to, and they just do, you know, 2 damage.
Yeah, exactly. Like Final Fantasy IV, as an example, Rosa, you'd just spam Kyurago all the time, and when no one needed healing, you'd cast Holy for massive damage. That's the entire strategy, and it's kind of bland after a while.
Do you like healers when they have more of a tank role? Like, healers, usually they're like fragile little girls or whatever. Maybe sometimes they have lots of HP to counteract the fact that they're not really doing a lot of attacking. I like the idea of a healer who's very much, who can take a lot of hits, who serves that function, right?
Yeah, definitely. I have a healer who can take a lot of hits and do a lot of damage. And that's really, it's a lot, like you said, it serves a lot of purpose. A lot of more functions open up to the character. And he's useful. He's not just cast heal on everyone and
whoa. He? You have a male healer? That's messed up, bro.
Way messed up.
It's a transsexual. It used to be female.
Okay, here's an idea. What about a game where there is no specific healer? Where there's not a character who has a healer role. What do you think about that idea?
Could you teach other characters how to heal, or is there no healing whatsoever? Aside from items.
I mean, I guess there's healing, sure, why not? It's just I mean, in my game, for example, I don't have a specific healer. You can teach healing skills to anybody you want to, and you can always use items. But I mean, in more of a general, as a thought experiment or, you know, something to talk about, is it possible for a game to have a lot of characters and not really have a specific healer?
I don't think so. It depends,
I think
again,
so.
Like you said.
You definitely can.
Well, personally, like what Despain said before, it depends on your central battle mechanic. For most Japanese RPGs, you really probably couldn't get away with that just because of how the battles play out. But I don't know. It depends.
I mean, in the fast-paced kind of thing he was talking about, usually your healer, they never even come into play until after tons and tons of battles where outside of the battle in the menu, you'll just use heal on your member so that you can keep going, but you can easily take out the healer for another party member and just stock up on whatever type of healing item that the game has.
Exactly, I hate that. The idea that the healer can become obsolete since you have healing items anyway. That's one of the reasons that I avoid a specific healer character in my own project.
Well, even then, you can just have a healer and give him or her more abilities. It doesn't have to be just a healer. Like, have a hybrid of classes, if you will. Another archetype is the standard magic user, the glass cannon, if you will. It has a high damage output, but at the same time dies in 2 hits. What are your opinions on that?
Well, for that type of character, it always makes sense that the one that usually can do the most damage has to have some kind of, you know, con to it, or else they just get too powerful. But I've never been that much of a fan of just the one character who can only use magic, and then once they can't use it anymore, they die, like, super quick.
Yeah, the one thing I don't like is the reliance on MP, magic points, skill points, whatever you want to call it. Without skill points, magic points, the character's absolutely useless. So I really want to try to give the magic character other skills that don't require MP, or at least a skill that takes no MP that recovers your MP.
Oh, yeah, about the skill you were talking about there, some games do have that skill. I a lot of the Final Fantasy have that skill. I think it's usually called osmosis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, with osmosis, since you were specific about it, it takes the enemy's MP and gives it to yourself, but sometimes, one, the enemy might not have a lot of MP, and two, the more common occurrence is it's absolutely useless and gives you like 40 MP a pop, which is really nothing.
It's just not worth a turn, which we're going to be getting into later on about the value of a turn. So my idea on this whole glass cannon type character is I don't necessarily associate it with the magic user. I like the idea of a quick striker character. They have high speed, high attack, or high magic attack, whichever one you want to do, and low HP. I don't necessarily think that it has to be associated with magic. I mean, sure, technically, I guess the physical striker is a different class, but when you really boil it down, the whole type of speedy, high attack, low HP, low defense character, it's all kind of the same thing for me.
Well, it depends on your game, too. Like, let's just take a quick tangent right now. If you have a very magic-based slash physical-based game, as in you have two different defenses for both, and you could actually do more damage to a boss because you use magic instead of physical attacks, you can also weigh that in the equation, too. It really depends, again, on your central battle system.
Yeah, that's a good point. It depends. It also depends on how many characters you have overall. Like, a game that only has four heroes might not need to have a separate magic user and a quick strike physical user, you know? But a character that has, you know, 100 different playable characters, like, you know, Suikoden or one of those kind of games. Am I even pronouncing that correctly? One of those games.
Suikoden, actually.
Suikoden, whatever. They have so many characters, it's easier to give each character a more specific area of expertise. Where when you only have, you know, three or four heroes, you really want to push those characters to a specific role, but at the same time, allow them to fill in the other roles where you don't have the extra characters to do that.
Well, let's go on one more tangent on my part. I guess let's say you have 10 heroes to choose from, and they're all fairly balanced. My question to you guys is, would you choose your heroes, and do you enjoy choosing your heroes based off of personality instead of stats? Like, an example would be Chrono Cross. It gave you literally 40 characters to choose from. You had a party of three, so your party would be consisted of members that you like personally on a personal level, as in how they interact with other people, their personality, all that stuff. All
right, I have some answers for that. I've never played Chrono Cross, but recently I have finally played Final Fantasy VII because it was on Steam.
Put an applause.
people talk about how it's like one of the greatest RPGs ever, and I've never played it up until last month or whatever, and I beat it. I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. But the characters that I used primarily were Cloud, obviously, Tifa, and Cid. Now, I used Cid because his personality was totally badass. Cid was a total all-star in personality. I didn't care about his stat. I actually ended up, you know, I equipped him with materia. He ended up becoming my healer. But I used him in my party because I thought he was really cool. Like, that's the whole reason I used him. Tifa, I didn't care that much about. But I used her for her stats because I had an equipment setup where she did a ton of damage for her regular attack. So for me, it's a little bit of both. I conceded the Tifa spot for her, even though she was kind of just like a bland, yeah, I'm a girl. That was like her entire personality, but and her tits. But I used her because she had such a strong attack that I used her a lot. But I also used Cid, even though he may not have been the strongest for what I was doing with him, because I think he was a badass. He was the coolest character in the game, in my opinion. So for me, it's a little bit of both.
He had the whole what the then question mark at symbol thing going on for him.
Yeah, and he abused his wife, which was funny. Not funny. Don't hate on us because I'm anti-feminist. I'll cut that part out.
Yeah,
please do. Yeah, please do.
Jet, what do you think on that that question?
This question actually reminds me more of the Mass Effect games, because
fuck yes, Mass Effect.
They choose their parties based usually more on what characters they like best.
Tally, you know? I loved Tally. Like literally, Tally. I loved her.
They want Garrus. They want Rex.
No, it's just
I like Kasumi in the second one. I like to take her with me.
It's just Shepard, Garrus, and then the third person. You will always have Garrus on your team, no matter what, unless you just have stupid.
I always had Garrus and Tally. They were my go-to.
Yeah, but see, they're both mostly like tech damage. Well, I mean, Garrus is a sniper, but he puts into the same type of pool of character. But you know, if you're already an infiltrator, like I usually play, I mean, stat-wise, it's not your smartest team to put in, but I do it anyway because they're my favorite characters, or I'll take my whoever I'm romancing that playthrough with me because they're supposed to be a good character, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, I like that a lot. The idea of how a character's personality affects your relationship to them within battle, which necessarily doesn't really factor into their personality much. I mean, a lot of times they will. There's overlap, obviously, like, you know, their personality sometimes goes into what their role is in battle. But sometimes it's not, which is something that I think is an interesting thing to talk about. What about characters who kind of break the stereotypes? For example, one of the characters that I had in mind for a project that is long abandoned was a fire magic, you know, hot-headed dude, but he was your healer because he had healing moves where it was like, you know, he used fire to, you know, cauterize your wounds. And even though he was the hot-headed, you know, rage character personality-wise, in battle he served a healer role. So what do you guys think about, you know, subverting those type of battle roles when it comes to personality?
As in, the character's personality wouldn't actually fit in with what his skills were?
Yeah, like a lot of time in RPGs you find that certain characters, you know what kind of role they're going to have in battle based on their personality, right? Like there's, you know, a girl and she's, you know, quiet and reserved and you know, oh yeah, she must be my healer. What do you think about breaking that kind of thing? What the project that I'm working on now, one of my characters is a very girly girl, but her role in battle, she's not the healer. She's a physical tank, and she does a bunch of physical damage, and that's her role in battle. And it kind of goes directly against what you'd expect based on her personality. What do you think about that kind of thing in RPGs?
It's not in my comfort zone, personally, but if every single character is the same way, that they have reversed roles, so to speak, then yeah, it's fine. But again, it's not in my comfort zone personally, so I can't actually have a good opinion of it.
I actually feel like it's kind of the opposite. If every character is like that, the gimmick you're trying to pull off it gets old really quick. If only one or two characters out of a few characters are like that, then I'm better with it.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. Where, you know, if there's one or two characters that totally throw your expectations around, then it can really be effective. But at the same time, you don't want to make your player confused, right? You don't want to set your player up to think that your character does one thing and then they do something else. So you'd have to establish it through gameplay to really let them understand what's going on. And that's something that I think that this podcast tries to talk about in general. One of the themes throughout all of our episodes is that gameplay itself is a language that you have to use to communicate with the player.
It's deep, man. It's really deep.
That's too deep for me.
All right, so let's before we move on to the skills, let's touch on briefly on a few more things about character roles, and that's about instead of assigning characters to their own specific roles, what do you think about the idea of fusing roles or merging them together or breaking them apart, or, you know, subverting them in other ways, especially in a kind of game that only has a few characters instead of 100 playable characters. How would you condense those to get so many roles within a few characters? Killam, what do you think about that?
It's simple. You can teach any character any skill you want, and their stats would kind of apply based on those skills. How about this? Final Fantasy VII, the Materia system. You controlled every single magic spell that your characters learned. So whatever your characters were, like you had three favorite characters. You had Cid, Tifa, and Cloud, right? You can make them however you
want.
Well,
I didn't like Tifa. I just used her.
That sounds really messed up.
My favorite characters were Cid and Barrett, but I never used Barrett, even though I thought he was a badass. I just never used him. I never got around to it.
Well, you know, what I was trying to say
is that... I fucking hated Kate Sith. That fucking traitor. Spoilers, by the way. He's a fucking traitor.
The game came out 20 years ago. I think it's okay.
Fucking, I haven't played it yet.
Fuck Kate Sith. He's a fuck... I knew something was fishy with him because he looked fucking fishy, right? So then, like,
Dude, there was that big scene... fucking toy.
I know. There was that big scene where he's like, hey, by the way, I was a traitor. I was like, I knew something fishy was up with you. That's why I never used you in my party, you little weirdo.
There's actually a mod that removes him completely from the game.
Oh,
there's
that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
And then there was that whole scene where, like, oh, I sacrificed my life, you know, and it's so dramatic, and then he shows up again, he's like, oh, by the way, I was just a toy, so it's okay that I died. It's like, why did I have that big dramatic scene? Like, ugh! I hate him. He ruined the game. Like, I enjoyed the game a lot more than I thought I would, but Kate Sith, just every time he spoke, I was like, just get out of this game. You're not human.
Play it with the mod, then. You'd like that.
I think I do want to replay the game with that mod, actually, now. And, like, the way he forced himself into my party, I was like, no, can I say no? He's like, hey, I'll come along. I was like, no, go away. I don't want you. Everybody else I was cool with. Like, Vincent, everybody says, like, Vincent's a total badass or whatever, and I guess he is, like, for 1990, whatever the game came out. Like, he was all quiet and, you know, hey, I'm a badass, like, trying so hard. And I used him in my party for a little bit, and then I replaced him with Tifa when I realized how badass she was in terms of stats. But, Deathbane, yeah, I talk about Final Fantasy VII. Hey, I played the game recently, though, so, I mean, people should be happy. Like, you know, for so many years, I've been, like, I've never played Final Fantasy VII, and then I finally have. And maybe I'm 10, 20 years behind on the train of talking about Final Fantasy VII, but, you know, so be it. Fuck Kate
Sith. To those of you who have no context, Despain hates JRPGs with a passion and can't stand them. So him playing Final Fantasy VII was a huge leap forward, I guess.
Okay, Jet, what do you think about the idea of consolidating character roles in the battle system?
Well, I mean, you have a few ways you can do it. You know, there's the Final Fantasy VII way where it's skill based, but at the same time the characters already have like stat trees. I'm pretty sure, like, how they level up, they get certain, you know, boosts into certain things, and then there's more of the class system like Final Fantasy V had, where if you change class, all of your stats change with it. You get all the new skills and stuff. You know, there's a few different ways to do it, and it really depends on how well it's executed to see which one's better.
Agreed there. I think that pretty much any system that you come up with can be excellent if it's well done, but it can also be really, really bad if it's poorly executed. So I think that's a good point that you brought up. One last thing I want to talk about characters is, do you have any... when it comes to original classes that aren't seen very often, like, you know, a lot of games have the healer and the mage and the thief or whatever, but what about some unique character classes that a lot of games might not have? For example, one of my old games, another, you know, failed project, there was a character who was a scarecrow. Like, literally, he was a scarecrow. And his gimmick was that he could never die. He was immortal. And, for the most part, his class was just a typical support character. He inflicted a lot of different status conditions. Like, his whole gimmick was, you know, I can poison you, I can do anything to you. But he did very low damage, but he could never, ever die. And it was my way of balancing the game in favor of casual players. You could never get a game over. He would always be able to self-sacrifice to heal the rest of your party. And I thought that was a really unique kind of class that a lot of RPGs, I haven't really seen that kind of thing before. That's just a example of the kind of thing that I'm talking about. A kind of class that is more game-specific or even world-specific, setting-specific to the kind of world that you have for your own game. What do you guys think about that kind of idea where you invent a class specific to your game? And I'm not talking about, like, you just rename a class to fit your setting, but, like, something new. Never mind.
I'm out. I don't have anything.
Yeah, I can't think of anything like that off the top of my head right now.
Well, actually, for my game, personally, since it's a typical JRPG, there's a lot of monsters, I took it a step further and I had, I guess, a monster morphing class. I don't know if you remember this, Des, it was a little while ago. Basically, you fight a monster, you capture him, and when you capture him, you can actually switch to him with a specific character and then inherit his stats and his skills and then use that character against other enemies.
So it's like a Pokemon trainer.
I guess so, yeah.
Like a shapeshifter.
Yeah, exactly. A monster morpher is the actual name of it.
That's cool. So I think that the idea of finding new classes, especially if you dig deep into your stats and what kind of skills are available to you, there are a lot more skills that are available to you. Even with the basic RPG mechanics, we're going to be getting onto that just in a little bit. But if you really look at those kind of things, see what's available to you, see what you can really do if you push the boundaries, you can actually come up with a lot in terms of unique classes or unique setups, where you can actually put a lot of originality in your game that you might not have thought about beforehand. So that's a good segue into the next topic, the idea of skills.
I thought of something.
Yeah?
I thought of something. In the Final Fantasy Legends games, I don't know what they were in Japan. They came out on the Game Boy, like the original one. You could be a class where you start out as a monster, and sometimes when you fight other monsters, you could eat their meat, and then that character would change into a different monster. Yeah, they would. No matter what it was, you could be fighting like robots, and at the end it'd be like, "Robot meat has been dropped. Would you like to eat it?"
And robot meat.
Yeah. And if you did that, that character would change into a different monster. Like, it wouldn't even necessarily be the monster who you just ate. It would just be some other monster.
Actually,
that's pretty cool.
What I want to add in real quick before we move on to the next topic would be, for unique characters, I would have at least one in any game just to differentiate what your game really is. Even if it's a hidden character, that's fine. Just have at least one original class with original skill set just to set it apart from everything else. It won't hurt you.
Yeah, and a good way to do that is by listening to this podcast for the next few minutes, because we're going to be talking about skills and thinking about how different skills can be applied more than just doing damage or whatever. So I'm going to let Killam start off on that conversation.
Well, yeah, skills and balancing is pretty much all I'm good at in terms of RPG Maker. So
you're certainly not good at graphics.
Definitely.
Okay. Anyone else want to keep throwing them out there? Let's go.
No, I'm good.
Okay, thanks. And one of the things that me and Des always go back and forth about and agree a lot about is a turn. A turn means damage. It means the player is going to win the battle if he keeps having them. A turn is the most important thing, obviously, of the player. And games that don't utilize this correctly, as in they have weak attacks, weak stat buffs, weak debuffs, pretty much useless turns is what you should always try to avoid. You want to give any examples, anyone?
Yeah, I want to talk about turns. You were kind of shitty because you brought up turns when I was trying to segue into unique skills, but we'll get into that a little bit later. The value...
I can just segue into unique skills right now. I was joking, actually, guys. Let's talk about unique skills.
I'm not going to cut any of this.
You're a dick.
Yeah, you are. I like Silverdesk better.
Okay, the idea of the value of a turn is something that that really came up to me when I play a lot of Magic. I talk about it a lot on the podcast and in my articles. I play Magic the Gathering a lot. I play it online. And the value of a turn in Magic is incredible. you know, there's this card called Time Walk. You can take an extra turn. It's one of the most powerful cards ever printed. It's in a group of cards called the Power Nine. That's probably tangential. Maybe I can cut that part. Maybe not, knowing me. But the value of a turn is the highest cost that you could pay for any skill or any movement that you can take in battle. Say, your regular attack does however much damage. It doesn't cost you anything, but it does cost you a turn. And consider there are games where you inflict poison on an enemy, right? Now, the poison does a little bit of damage every turn. But if your battle is not going to last enough turns where the poison doesn't do enough damage equal to a single attack, then you might as well have done an attack during that turn. Every turn is equal to the amount of damage that you can do equal to a basic attack. I'm not sure if that makes sense because I'm not in a totally sober state of mind right now. Maybe Killam can expand on that.
I'll give you guys a perfect example. You have a stat buff that boosts your attack by whatever percentage. Let's say it's 20%. Now, one character casts a buff for 20%. His turn is wasted just for a 20% buff.
Because he doesn't do any damage.
Yeah, it does nothing. It does something. 20%, I figure, would add on like 50 more damage. It might be a lot based on context. But anyway, 20% is nothing. In my game, one stat buff is 75% because you are not wasting a turn. You're contributing to how much damage you do all the time, regardless of whatever action you take.
You really have to think about it more mathematically than just saying, oh, 10%, oh, I'll give him 25% off. You know, you have to... I mean, if you have a 20% boost on attack onto a character, let's say you cast it on that character himself, that would take 5 turns to pay off for the turn that you just missed. Now, if you give him 75% attack boost, you know, that only takes 2 turns, and then suddenly you've already paid off that turn that you missed.
Yeah, and what's wrong with that? The player's being rewarded by making a smart decision by doing a lot more damage than normal. That's what you want to do. You want your player to feel rewarded, and you want him to feel like he's doing a lot of damage all the time. That's what a turn is.
Exactly,
yeah, and that goes back to the combat system mechanics that we were talking about earlier. Whether you're doing a fast paced battle or you're doing more drawn out battles, because buffs are almost only useful for the drawn out battles. If you have a fast paced battle, that's going to end in 2 turns anyway. There's no point in throwing in a 75% buff because the battle's going to be over after one attack anyway.
Except for bosses, of course. Like that's probably what you're going to be using buffs more with.
That's a great point. The whole idea of a buff, if you're not doing damage during that turn, then the buff itself is a wasted turn if the battle itself isn't going to be going long. Like, you have to get enough damage overall to be worth that turn. Say you attack, and your regular attack does 100 damage, right? And you buff somebody so they do 10% more. If you're battle doesn't last long enough for that buff to do more than 100 damage, then it was not worth the turn, because you might as well just have attacked and the battle would have been over anyway. So when I look at it, I like to approach buffs and debuffs from the perspective where they should be very, very strong. 50% or more for me. If there's an attack that does 10% buff for a character or for your whole character, for your whole team even, that doesn't seem very, very worth it, because you might as well just spam the attack button and get enough damage over the course of the battle. I think that the whole idea of the value of a turn is incredibly important. And the idea that you might as well just be attacking, a lot of games that I've played, you know, instead of buffing, you just do attacks. Just spam attack, and you can get there just as fast anyway. A good example of this is in Pokemon games. Some of the buffs...
I was going to say that.
Pokemon is the best example for everything. It's such a good game. Some buffs are really bad.
Swords, oh, never mind.
That's what I'm getting to, actually. Some of them are really bad. Like, they'll, you know... generally, in Pokemon, they increase by stages. But some of them, if you used a buff attack in Pokemon that increased your attack, why would you do that when you can use Swords Dance, which increases your attack and your speed?
No, right? This just does attack two stages, 100%.
I was thinking of Dragon Dance.
Oh, Shell something, Shell Break or some shit.
Shell Smash.
Yeah, there you go.
Dude, that is incredible. When I was training my team, I had a Barbaracle, and he had Shell Smash. That move is fucking OP. Anyway,
I think
it's
banned. No, it's not. Never mind.
It's not banned. But some sets are banned, I think, by Smogon. Anyway, the idea is that if you're in general, if you're buffing, it has to be worth a turn. It has to be worth the turn of damage that you're losing out on. Over the course of the battle, you have to be doing more damage because of the buff than you would have if you had just attacked during that turn. In some games, if battles go long, if that's the kind of thing you're doing, or during a boss battle, then it's going to be worth it. In other games, your buffs might not even be worth using, in which case you have to wonder, why would I put this buff skill in my game at all? And then you have to think, you know, maybe I can make it stronger. Maybe I can make it better. I always err on the side of buffs being very strong. Buffs, debuffs. Jeez, that's a funny word when you say it a lot of times. They should be very powerful. They should be really, really worth it. If I buff a character, they should be doing 150 to 200% of their regular attack to make it worth the turn that I'm spending to use it. Here's another way of thinking about it. In Pokemon, there are some moves where you can attack, it does damage, and it also buffs you as a side effect. Maybe it's, you know, 50%, you get a buff. 25%, you get a buff. Either way, you're also doing damage, so it's an incidental buff. You get a enhancement as a side effect. And in that case, you're not thinking, hey, that was a waste of a turn, I didn't do any damage, because you did do damage, and you also got the extra effect. I think that's a great way to balance it out. If you can do damage and also buff the rest of your team, or buff a single character, while also doing damage, your player isn't sitting there thinking, hey, I wasted a turn doing nothing. He's thinking, I did damage, and I also got an extra bonus. I think that's an awesome way to do it. Pokemon does that with a few moves. That's the way I would encourage a lot of people to do it. If they're not willing to make buffs incredibly powerful, make them incidental on top of regular damage. I think that's an awesome way to make them not feel useless in the eyes of the player.
Well, what you said before was, for long battles, at the end of the battle, the buff obviously has to pay off. And what Jet mentioned before was the whole mathematical equation aspect of you were boosted by 75%, and in two turns, the boost paid off already. So what's a safe amount of turns for you to actually have that payoff and then some, would you say?
It depends entirely on your game. We talked about it at the top of the episode. How many turns is an average battle in your game? And I think that's a really good point to bring up, actually. When you're first setting out your battle system, you're balancing all of your skills, all of your stats, you have to think on average, how many turns do you want an average battle to be? Now, in some games, you might think, you know, 3-4 turns is enough for an average battle. Other games, maybe more strategic games, you know, those kind of games like Final Fantasy Tactics, where you move your characters around, where the battles are pretty much everything, you know, those are good, those go really long, there's a lot of turns. But there are some games where, you know, turns could only, you know, a battle could only last, you know, 3 turns. It really, really is game specific. So you have to balance your entire game. This is like a main point for this entire episode. You have to balance your entire game around how many turns each battle takes. And it's different depending on your game itself. How battle-centric your game is. Battle-centric, if that's a cool word. Or if, you know, depending on how strategic your game is. I mean, obviously you want strategy in your RPGs, but sometimes players don't really want to, you know, be bogged down by strategy when they're fighting, you know, random hordes on their way to the boss, or if they're grinding or something. You have to really think on average in terms of when the player is, don't think about bosses, in terms of what I'm talking about right now, the whole general idea of you know, the average battle, how many turns do you want it to take? And I think getting that kind of idea is massively important in terms of all of these things we're talking about and other things in terms of balancing your game and making sure that everything fits together importantly and how everything, you know, meshes all of these different game mechanics, how they come together. How many turns does an average battle take? And I think when you can really lock that down for your game, you can have a good idea of how you want to design your battle system around it.
I don't really agree with that, having an average
battle. Well, you're wrong, good sir.
I'm not, and I'll show you why. All right, now, let's say you have a strategic battle system and every single battle is strategic. Chances are you do the same thing over and over again. And my game, I have, I guess, the popcorn swarm, as in people who die in one hit. That's what I call them, the popcorn swarm.
It's based, I like, off that, like, idea.
Yeah, it's enemies that are weak. They die in one hit. You don't have to worry about them. And then you have the medium enemies who require some strategy, hitting a weakness. And then you have the larger... Right there, buddy?
I'm drunk.
Oh, sorry. And then you have the larger mid-bosses, which require a lot of strategy. And then the bosses, which require everything. So you should have different tiers of battles and mix it up constantly, because you don't want the same 7-battle-long, drawn-out strategy over and over and over again. It just really bogs the player down.
Agreed completely on that point, that battles should be varied. But when you're thinking about balancing your battle system, you should have an idea of, you know, when my character is at the level that he should be at this specific dungeon or, you know, this point in the game. When he's at the right level, the average battle should last, you know, 3 to 5 turns. Maybe you're thinking about it that way. Or the average battle should last, you know, 7 to 10 turns. If it's a game that's really focused on that kind of strategic battle system. When you have that kind of idea locked down, it's a lot easier for you as a developer to balance these kinds of things and understand how much each buff should matter, how much each turn equals in terms of damage. Obviously, these kinds of things come with playtesting. I can't stress this enough. All of these things we're talking about, you're going to playtest. You're going to go back and modify them over and over and over again. You can't just, you know, settle on it and say, oh yeah, this is fine, whatever. You have to play your own game, go back, and realize how much damage is a turn worth. That comes with playtesting. But before you even get to that point, it's a good thing, it's a good idea to have in your head, do I want long battles in my game, or do I want short battles and more of them? Or do I want, you know, less battles and they should be longer and more intense, or what have you? Anyway, I think we've pretty much covered that area of discussion. Killam, where do you want to go from here?
I actually want to take one last tangent. We talked about buffs and everything, and you briefly went over debuffs. And I just want to stress that debuffs are like buffs. Don't make them useless, please. And an example in my game is every single debuff, like poison, berserk, it can hit any enemy.
Poison isn't a debuff.
Isn't it? Okay, I'm sorry. Status effects. Okay, so any status effects can hit any boss, including the final boss. How do I get around this? The resistance to the status effect comes into play with how many turns the debuff or status effect lasts. Like, stuff like that you have to really play around with to make status effects useful. Because every game I've ever played, really almost every single game, has had status effects useless because they don't do enough damage.
Except
every
Pokemon.
Single boss is resistant to them. Actually, yeah, that's a good point.
Pokemon is a shining example of this exact idea, where status effects and buffs and debuffs actually matter. Pokemon does a fantastic job of making it worth the turn.
Yeah, I agree completely. I guess with that out of the way, you guys want to move on to the next topic? Want to add anything to that, Jet?
No. You guys actually covered it pretty well this time.
One of my problems with a lot of RPGs in general is just the amount of skills that are useless. Like, A perfect example of this would be something me and Onion went back and forth. Sorry, me and Onion. Me and Despain went back and forth.
He Onion's has, a damn good nickname.
Okay, I know. I just got caught up, sorry. Is the argument of having multiple spell types of different calibers of strength. Like, you have Fire 1, Fire 2, and Fire 3. And initially, I disagreed with him because he likes to take the upgrade route, if you want to explain that.
Yeah, the idea is that if you have a skill called Fire 1, for example, it does however much damage fire, right? Fire-type damage. And then you later on, you get Fire 2, which is the same exact skill, except it costs more MP and does more damage. But otherwise, it's pretty much the same thing, right? Well, the idea is that your character is leveling up. So you have more SP or MP to use. So it's really not that much of a cost. It just does more damage. I don't like the idea of having more than one skill that does the exact same thing. Like, why would you want Fire 1 and Fire 2 if you can just have Fire 2? There's the common, you know, people are like, well, it costs less, you know, MP. Well, why does that matter? If you're progressing through the game, then your MP, your maximum MP is also progressing. So you just want to upgrade the skill. Killam, do you want to talk about the idea of upgrading these skills instead of just having a bunch of them in your inventory at the same time?
Well, yeah, initially I actually disagreed with you. I remember a couple months ago I said, no, I don't like that idea. I like to have Fire 1, Fire 2, and Fire 3. And the biggest reason I actually wanted to have multiple skills that did the same thing but had a lower MP cost was the MP argument that what if I don't want to waste 50 MP on a normal monster, or what if I don't have all the MP? But then what you have to do is you have to look at your game from the player's aspect. I mean, sure, having three skills of varying MP cost sounds good on paper, but now put yourself in the position where you're fighting a very strong boss and he has like millions of HP. What are you going to do? Are you going to cast a fire spell for 4 damage or a fire spell for 4,000 damage? Now, the other argument is, okay, I don't have enough MP to cast the one for 4,000 damage, so I'll just cast the one for 4 damage. That's not realistic.
That's not worth a turn.
Exactly. Realistically, you'd heal your MP and then do the one that does 4,000 damage. So yeah, on paper, the explanation for having multiple skills of varying MP costs that do the same thing sounds good. But realistically, it's useless and it's bloat.
I'm more into the upgrading skills than the Fire 1, Fire 2. More so because I feel like Fire 1, Fire 2, you know, Fire 3, or Fire Guff. I think the next one's like Fire Jaw, whatever they want to do.
It's Firaga and Firaha.
Yeah, no. I feel like it never makes sense in context with the world. Like, do you think a mage is going to go and read a spell book and be like, oh, it looks like Fire 1 is on page 3 and Fire 2 is on page 6. Why isn't it just fire, you know, and put more fire into
that's a damn good point. Yeah, I like the idea of when you learn Fire 2, it should overwrite Fire 1. It should just
be... exactly.
There's no reason to use it for the rest of the game. I mean, sure, there's corner case scenarios, but those come up so rarely that it's simply not worth it. If you're using Fire 1 to save the MP, Fire 2 usually does enough damage where you might as well just spend the turn to recover your MP, and then you can use 3 or 4 Fire 2s, and it's worth the turn. Which, yeah, exactly. Again, comes into the idea of the value of a turn.
Yep.
Where Fire 1 is not worth wasting a turn where you can use the upgraded form of it. Alright, so the idea is that you don't want a lot of skills blocking up the menu. When you're doing website design, something I've learned over the years is that the value of a click is a lot. You don't want your visitor to click through a lot of links to get where he wants to go. And the same idea can be applied to menus in your RPGs. You don't want your player to have to scroll down 100 times to get to the skill that he wants. when you have so many skills clogging up the menu, skills that he's never going to use, like Fire 1 when he has Fire 2, why would you have that there in the first place? You want to really clear it up. And I think that not only in terms of inputs from the player, in terms of aesthetics, it's a lot cleaner, it's a lot purer, it's simply better to have a more simplified menu where he can just go where he wants and do what he does what he wants to do. There's a joke that I make a lot about JRPGs in general. I call them menu games, and I joke that instead of having gameplay, they have menu play, where you just play through the menus instead of actually playing the game. And that joke comes from this idea where you're scrolling through menus instead of just playing what you want to do. And the more you can minimize the amount of clicks or the amount of scrolling that the player has to do, the tighter the gameplay is and the stronger the whole experience is for the player, the less he'll be thinking less about, hey, I spent so much time, you know, scrolling through my menus to find the fire skill that I want to use, instead of using fire, you know, scrolling past Fire 1 to get to the skill that he really wants to use. He'll just use the one that he wants to use, and he'll light his enemy on fire and win the battle.
Yeah, that's, I feel the same way. Just completely cut every single useless skill. People who have 18 skills, just to say, I have 18 skills on one character, stop making a game and just go away, because that's not how you do it. I'm serious.
Well,
I've actually
it's okay, because they're never going to finish anyway.
Yeah, that's true. They'll be busy making 800 skills and not make the actual gameplay. But it is true, though. I've seen people do that, like brag about 400 skills. Like, okay, I'll bet you $30 I'm going to use 5 of those 400 skills only. So you know what?
30, nigga, please, I'll bet 100.
That I'm right? Or you're? I'm okay with that.
No, on the same bet. You bet $30, I would have bet over 100.
Well, then I'll put it in 150, asshole.
Let's not strain ourselves thinking about numbers here.
No, but it's seriously, that it's true. Don't do that. My game is heavily skill-based. You're always going to be using skills to attack monsters, and every single ally has 8 skills, and they're all incredibly useful. I actually linked a bunch of people to the Spain's Dismay, a list of my character skills to see if they thought something was useless, and pretty much no one said anything was useless. That's what you have to do. Make every skill count.
Well, I mean, it's easy to have nobody say that none of the skills are useless when nobody was looking.
I had, like...
they were just being
I had, like,
nice.
20 people critique it, actually.
So, on the topic of skills, something that I want to talk about is the idea of, you know, it comes into the whole the value of a turn thing, but it's also more than that, because the idea of skills themselves can be so much more than most RPGs have. A lot of RPGs have your typical skills that do damage, plus they have an element associated with it. But then there are skills, again, we're going back to Pokemon, but the best example I can think of is the move Trick Room in Pokemon. And it warps the entire battle, where the Pokemon with the slowest speed goes first instead of last. And these kind of skills can really, really add a lot of strategic value to the game, and they can also make your game just a lot more fun and varied in general. The kind of skills that just warp the game mechanics, or the kind of skills that use mechanics that are often overlooked. Like, there's a move in Pokemon called Grass Knot. It's a grass-type move, but it does extra damage if your opponent is really heavy. And that's something that's... it's a variable built into the Pokemon, their weight. And it's usually, you know, in the old games, it was just displayed in the Pokedex. Like, oh, this Pokemon is however much weight. But when they introduced the move Grass Knot, suddenly you could, you know, you basically the whole idea of it was you trip your Pokemon, and it did more damage if they were heavy. And I think that kind of idea is a really good example of the kind of thing that you could do if you think a little bit outside of the box. What kind of moves you can do, what kind of skills you can create that, you know, deal additional damage or create a unique status effect or warp the battle itself, like Trick Room, based on the kind of things that are available to you as an RPG developer that might be overlooked by the average RPG player. So Killam, what do you think about this kind of thing?
Here's the problem with that. If you stray away from the general formula too much, then it becomes very situational. Like Grassknot, for example, what if you're fighting light enemies? It's not going to do anything. It's a wasted skill slot. So I think you really have to actually stay as close to the general formula as possible. But when you stray, keep in mind that if you do stray, you're going to make something situational. And you really want to avoid that for the most part. Because, again, you want every skill to have meaning and every skill to be powerful in some way.
Yeah, agreed there. It's not something that you should do for every skill. For example, in the game that I'm working on now, one of the skills does damage equal to the amount of items that you have in your inventory of a certain type. Like, it's a rocket thing. He shoots rockets. And the more fuel cells you have in your inventory, the more damage it does. And, you find those throughout the game, or you buy them, or whatever. And for the most part, if you don't collect those items, the skill is weak. You might as well just use a regular attack. But if you build up towards it, then it can do tremendous damage. The idea is that these types of skills, they add more depth to your game for the players who want to explore that kind of depth. But for the player who doesn't want to go in that direction, he can simply ignore it and not use it. So for that reason, I think that it's a good idea to include these kind of skills for the players who want to go in that direction, but you shouldn't force it on them. You should always have the kind of basic skills that do, a certain amount of damage, elemental damage, or, whatever. But at the same time, I think it's a really cool idea, and it's a clever idea to have a few here and there additional skills that can really reward a player for going deep, if you want to think about it that way. While, obviously the majority of the skills in your game will have a more basic function that the everyman player can, apply to his way of progressing through battles. But I think that it's a really good idea to have a few skills here and there that are really unique and use game mechanics that might be unique to your game or might involve stats that are overlooked in most RPGs. Killam, do you want to add on to this point?
Not really. You kind of covered it perfectly, actually. But again, I just want to stress not to stray too far, because situational skills are completely useless except for specific situations, and that they just take up a skill slot that you don't want to have.
Yeah, like we said before about the whole idea of you don't want a lot of skill slots, there are a few that you can use. And typically, in an RPG Maker specifically, you'll notice that your skills are listed in order that you have them in the database. So this is an important skill to use if you're using RPG Maker. Towards the end, I'll have the skills that are more gimmicky. So, like I talked about, the skill that where my character would do damage equal to the amount of fuel cells that he has in an inventory, that was typically at the bottom. Because even though it might not be as high a level a skill as something else, I would still place it below the others, because not all players would want to get to it. And the players who do want to get to it, who have invested the time into it, it would be worth it for them to scroll down there. And I'm talking about this in the sense that, the character that I'm talking about, he doesn't have like 45 skills. He has, maybe 8 or 9, So it's not a huge deal for him to get to the gimmicky skills that some players can really enjoy. And that's an important idea that I want to convey to you, that some players might really enjoy these kinds of unique skills. Some players might not. Killam, do you want to talk a little bit about the idea of how some players might enjoy some things, but some player might not enjoy others?
Well, actually today, Despain linked me to a tutorial on his site. That's FinalBossBlues.com. It's FinalBossBlues.com. But yeah, and he talked about different player demographics and psychologies, whatever. Profiles, psychological profiles, and how they enjoy the game. And one of the things that a lot of people enjoy doing is actually breaking the game skill-wise and exploiting special skills and special combinations to do a shitload of damage. And I guess you want to give us an example?
Well, the best example is actually, again, Trick Room from Pokemon. It's the best example I can think when I, you know, it's so perfect for talking about these kinds of things. It literally warps the battlefield so the slowest player moves first. And there are entire teams of Pokemon that people build with slow Pokemon, the whole point of which is that they can go first even though they're slow, which counteracts the downside of being slow but powerful. And I just think it's the perfect example. You can build a team of Trick Room-based Pokemon where they're all slow, they deal a bunch of damage, but they move first after you use that move. So it warps the game mechanics in the favor of your build. And enabling your player to do that kind of thing, to change the fundamental game mechanics while also using the game mechanics, I think is a really genius way to add a lot of novelty and interactivity to a game for a certain type of player who enjoys that kind of thing.
Yeah, and my counter argument initially was, hey, that's way too strong, man. You're going to break the game. But if the player puts in the effort to break the game, he should get rewarded for it by doing a shitload of damage all the time. The player did it for a reason, and he should be able to exploit it. Don't ever give your game, I guess, a cheat code for itself to not let the player take advantage of it. Because if the player does damage, he's happy. He wants to do damage. Let the player do what he wants to do.
That's the hugest thing that I want to talk about. I mean, I say it a lot. Reward the player for what he wants to do. Especially when we're talking about these kind of RPGs, where they're typically single player. You don't have to worry about breaking some kind of online metagame where players are playing against each other. If you're designing a JRPG or a WRPG, whatever, if you're using RPG Maker, for the most part, you're making a game that's single player. And if a character is overpowered or whatever, so what? The player is happy. I mean, obviously you don't want to make him overpowered to the point where the player can just, you know, mash through the game without trying. But if you allow combinations that the player can find that makes his character overpowered in comparison to the enemies, that's fine. He's not being compared to other players online. He's playing against the computer itself. So he feels rewarded. He feels, hey, wow, I broke the game. He feels good about himself. Obviously, you don't want to go too far. You don't want to let him just smash through the game, find some combination that lets them not have any challenge whatsoever. But if your player, if you include a way in your game for your player to feel powerful, then he will feel like he did the work. Usually you want to do this with a combination of elements. You know, give the player the tools to find a way, change the mechanics of the game, or change the way the battle system works, you know, through skills or, you know, combinations of skills and equipment and those kind of things, where he can feel like he broke it, you know, where he can feel like, hey, I did this awesome thing. And even though you put it in there, the player feels like he figured it out for himself. And that whole idea of rewarding the player for doing something that he wanted to do in the first place, it's immensely satisfying from the player's perspective. And that's what your job as a game developer, that's what your job is, to make the player feel satisfied, make it feel like it was his idea in the first place. And he'll feel so happy, and he'll feel like, hey, I love this game because I did this awesome thing.
Yeah, it
makes you feel better than the developer, like, oh, I broke your game because I'm great. I'm gonna keep playing it and see what else I can break.
Yeah, that's also a really good point. Like, all the speedrunners, like Legend of Zelda, Ocarina? I don't know how to say Ocarina. Is it Ocarina?
Ocarina.
Okay, Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time speedrunners are the cockiest douchebags on the planet because they think that they trumped the developers. And they did, in a sense. And you know what? That makes them happy. So give your players the same experience. Let them feel like a cocky asshole. Who cares? They're having fun.
Yeah, exactly. Ocarina's been out for, what, 20 years now? And players are still playing the game and enjoying it because they're playing it in ways that it wasn't intended.
Yeah, Metroid Prime 2 is a good example. We had that, the speedrun, what, Awesome Games Quick, and they had a developer for Metroid Prime actually giving commentary while they were playing the game, But speedrunners, since they're so just arrogant and they're dicks, they didn't let him speak because they thought they knew more about the game than him because they broke it. And I was just so pissed off. I love Metroid Prime, and I wanted to suck this guy's dick because he made the game. And I couldn't because the freaking Asian guy thought he knew everything about the game. I wanted to fucking stab him. I hated that guy so much. He just ignored the developer completely. I just was angry the whole night.
Anyway, I think we're reaching the point where we've pretty much talked about what we want to talk about in terms of your hero's role in battle, the role of your characters, their stats, their roles, their skills, that kind of thing. So, Jet, do you have any final thoughts on the subject?
Well, I actually wanted to throw out two specific skills that I've seen in some RPGs before that I just wanted to get a quick opinion from you guys on. Rewind and repeat, and one of which throws you back a turn as if the last turn had never even happened, and the other one just throws you back to the beginning of the battle. What do you guys think about those kinds of skills?
I love that idea. It depends on how it's implemented, obviously. Going back a turn, like, it recovers their HP and stuff. I think that's really cool. I think it's smart. It can add a lot of strategy. It can also serve as a sort of undo button for the player if he messes up. And there's one thing that I always love to do, and that's let the player, you know, overcome his mistakes. I think that it's our job as game developers not to, you know, make the game hard for the player, but to make it challenging. And if the player is able to go back and redo a mistake, then it's more challenging than hard because he's able to, you know, say, oh, I made this wrong decision, I can redo it, instead of saying, oh, I have to, you know, reset from my save point forever. The idea of redoing a battle from the beginning, I think, is really smart. Obviously, it's not going to work in every game, but in some games, it can be used to wonderful effect. I think that's a really cool idea for a skill.
Yeah, it depends on your battle system, again. If it's heavily strategic-based, of course you want to have a skill that undoes previous turn. Why wouldn't you want to do that? What if you messed up? If it's one of those games where you just attack as fast as possible, there's really no need unless you are using RNG for some reason, and you really shouldn't rely on that.
Well, I mean, I just wanted you guys' opinions on it, because I don't remember how long ago, it was probably a few months ago, that somebody wanted me to make that type of mechanic for them, both of them.
That was me.
I knew it. I thought it was you. And I was like, you know, I've seen this before, and I don't know. I always thought being able to redo your turn was really handy, and at the same time, like, it's almost like their mistakes don't matter. Like, it doesn't matter because you can just go back and redo it anyway.
Well, sometimes it shouldn't matter. It depends a lot on your audience. Modern games, you know, if you're releasing it on Steam or for a more casual audience, you might want to put that kind of option in there to let the player, you know, rewind, you know, so they don't feel like, you know, I mean, there are so many hundreds of thousands of games out there now. You don't want your player to feel like he's wasting his time. Whereas in 1992, he had his game for the SNES, and that was all he had. So if he, you know, he died, he'd be happy playing, you know, 20 minutes of the same thing over again because that was all he could do. So the audience is a huge factor in that kind of mechanic. And I think that in the modern world, it's a good idea to give your player some kind of a fail-safe.
Yeah, that makes sense, what you're saying. You know, the player is either a pleb or they're not. That's what makes a difference.
If you're a hardcore or you're casual. All right, so Killam, what are your final thoughts on the subject?
If you take nothing from this podcast, please take this away. Make your buffs, your turns matter. Make each and every single action that you take as a player and as a developer matter so the player wants to play your game more. I can't stress that enough.
Yeah, agreed there. The value of a turn should not be underestimated from the developer side. The player, you can't count on your player to recognize the value of a turn. As a developer, when you're balancing your game, when you're designing your game, when you're test playing your game, you have to recognize how valuable each turn is. Because your player might not necessarily realize it, but he's going to feel it when he's playing the game. And I think that's a very important point. I think that's a great point for this episode in general to hammer home the value of a turn when you're playing an RPG type game in battle.
Well, if I'm going to bring anything up, I want to bring up just two things. One is just to reiterate that I shouldn't have any wasted turns. I shouldn't feel like I'm wasting my time in your battle or in your game at, you know, almost any point. And two, if I sound a little nasally, it's just because I'm sick. I'm usually a lot more charismatic.
And if I sound nasally, it's because I'm drunk.
And if I sound nasally, it's because the speed's drunk.
All right. Thank you all for listening. As always, you can catch up with the newest episodes on finalbossblues.com. This has been the first episode in a very long time. Hopefully, we're going to start to pick up on a somewhat regular schedule again. Like I've said multiple times, it's difficult because everybody has their own jobs and we're all super busy with our own projects. So I can't promise a regular weekly schedule, but hopefully this is the beginning of a new chapter in the podcast. We can get some regular episodes up again. And again, you can find them on finalbossblues.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at finalbossblues. You can follow Killam on Twitter at KillamIG.
The IG stands for is great.
The IG stands
for indie games.
The IG stands for Killam Indie Games. Killam IG.
Or is gay if you want to be a dick.
Like us on Facebook. Check out the website. And we'll see you next time. Thank you all for listening.
All right. Yeah, that was a great podcast. But I got a jet, so.
His name is Captain Jet, and he's gonna jet, which means he's like a plane because his nickname is Jet, so it's a joke. It's funny.
I'm also drunk.
Okay. Really? Wow. Since when?
Yeah, it just kicked in.
Alright, then let's party.
I can't believe you're being so unprofessional.
This is all staying in the podcast.
No, it's not, though. It's not.
Woo! I'm feeling it, buddy. We should totally play Loadout after this.